Well, I want to thank everybody for coming this afternoon, and in many ways, what I was looking at is somewhat similar to the previous talk in that we were looking at some variables that really co-occur with each other and try to think about how to either distinguish which of the individual variables are the most important or whether we should be looking at some way of clustering them. And what I'm going to present is a more traditional epidemiologic approach, but I think it'll leave you at the end kind of thinking about how we should measure these things. So the title of the talk is oral sex or smoking associated with prevalent oral HPV infections in college women. And we had a huge team of researchers, about half of whom were MPH students and really a good public health team. And we do want to acknowledge that we did receive funding for this study from Merck, who makes the HPV vaccine, although they gave me no restrictions on what we could talk about. So oral human papillomavirus infections are associated with head and neck cancers involving the tonsils and the base of the tongue, and especially HPV type 16. These HPV-associated cancers are increasing in prevalence, especially in older persons, those persons, for example, over age 50. But there's been a lot of press implying causal associations among things like oral sex. If you look, for example, at the women's health literature, like the Journal of Women's Health, and then the lay press, and the Glamour and Cosmo and whatnot, you'll see a lot of discussion about whether oral sex is associated with HPV. You also see a lot of news media and a lot of people offering testing for oral HPV. And so there's sort of a buzz out there about it. But it's really, from a public health standpoint, unclear whether screening and intervention are needed, and in which groups or settings should you do oral HPV screening. What is known about oral HPV infections from several mostly cross-sectional studies is that it does seem to be more common in older people compared to younger people, 2 to 3 times more common in males compared to females, and certainly it is 5 to 10 times more common in people with HIV infection compared to those without HIV infection. We know that genital HPV is very common in college women. In fact, about 80% of sexually active college women, if followed serially, will often have HPV at some point, most of which is transient. But the few studies of oral HPV in younger women suggest a very low prevalence, maybe 1 to 4%. And we also need to identify risk factors, but also possible protective factors that may help people avoid oral HPV infections. So the study objectives were to determine the prevalence of oral HPV infections in college women, to determine the risk factors and possible protective factors for oral HPV, and to determine the persistence of oral HPV over 12 months of follow-up. Our population, we recruited 1,010 college women who provided valid samples. They were all recruited from a student health care center in 2011. With our big team, we were actually able to recruit these 1,000 women in approximately 3 to 5 months. So it was actually an exciting experience for the recruitment team. The data collection, our participants completed wireless surveys using netbooks that we brought, and they provided an oral sample by gargling with a mouthwash for 30 seconds and providing it. The laboratory testing, the samples were sent to a lab where they were tested first for any HPV using a commercial assay, and then they were tested for type-specific HPV using a Roche linear assay that looks for 37 specific subtypes, most of which have some association with cervical cancer. Now, as far as our survey measures, we tried to think about what's not known, what could be causally associated with oral HPV in these college women. So certainly other studies have shown that oral sex and kissing were associated. We were actually interested in what we're calling self-inoculation, that is somehow a woman might be transferring genital HPV from the genital area where it is common to the mouth, so we devised some questions to look at that. Smoking is commonly associated, and we wanted to get more detail about whether it was marijuana smoking or hookah smoking or whether shared smoking or cigarette smoking. Alcohol consumption also is a broad topic, and we looked at several other oral and reproductive health factors that might be associated with oral HPV. And then finally, we were interested in whether women who had received any HPV vaccination would be protected against oral HPV. We conducted both bivariate and multivariable analyses, with the main outcome being any oral HPV. And our focus was a little bit on the sex, smoking, and alcohol because, as I mentioned, these have been shown to be independent risk factors in previous literature. But as you all probably know, they overlap a lot. And so in terms of how you distinguish whether one of these is more causally associated with the outcome than others is very challenging. And we also wanted just to explore some of the other variables that I mentioned to see if we could find any interesting associations. So we also did a stratified analysis to look at some of the teasing apart of the sex and alcohol and smoking. And we also did create an index variable. Late in class could be an interesting way to think of it, but I'll show you the data from the index variable and you can see what you think. But we really were trying to see if we could distinguish whether any one of these was truly a stronger risk factor than the other. So in terms of the results, the prevalence of oral HPV in our 1,010 women, 19 women had any oral HPV, so it's a prevalence of 1.9%. 10 of those 19 had a subtype identified, and I list them here. Almost all of these are associated with cervical cancer in some way, but only two had HPV-16, and really HPV-16 is of all the HPVs present in 90% of the HPV-associated oral head and neck cancers. So 16 really is the bad player, and most of you may know that HPV-16 is one of the types that's in the HPV vaccine. 9 women had no subtype identified, and in some ways we really don't know much about what those HPV viruses really mean. Now we requested follow-up from 10 women who had subtype specific because we wanted to see if their long-term follow-up would be persistent within subtype, and we also recruited 20 matching controls to see what would happen to them over time. This result shows our bivariate analysis, and the HPV proportion of girls who had the HPV is shown in the final column there. And what you can see is our race, we actually had a very racially diverse sample with about 50% white, 15% black, 15% Hispanic, and 10% Asian. And the other categories, mostly people who identified as a combination of races. And you can see that really HPV prevalence didn't vary much. It was 1 to 2% in this group. Age categories, at least in our sample, potentially slightly less than the older girls. But I'll keep in mind that with these low numbers, it's difficult to claim that these are statistically significant, and they're not. And then under HPV vaccine, at least these data suggest that the girls who had gotten either 1, 2, or 3 vaccine shots were slightly less likely to have oral HPV, but again, not really statistically significant. And when we look at alcohol use, let me orient you to this slide. On the side y-axis there, you see the overall prevalence of HPV in each subgroup, and across the bottom, these are girls who reported drinking none weekly or less, 2 to 3 times a week, or 4 or more times a week. And the number of girls who reported drinking 4 or more times a week was relatively low. But you certainly do see what appears to be a dose-response relationship with alcohol, drinking, and HPV. Smoking, this bar, we did want to try to tease out whether marijuana or tobacco or any smoking really made a difference. And again, the proportion of HPV is on the y-axis and the frequency of smoking is across the bottom. The first bar, the dark blue, are cigarette smoking. The light blue bar is marijuana smoking. And the orange bar is any smoking. And in this sample, marijuana smoking was slightly more common than tobacco smoking in this group of college women. Hookah smoking also was similar, but most people who reported hookah smoking was a little less common, like weekly or less than weekly. But as you can see, again, pretty consistently, it looks like a dose-response relationship between smoking and the outcome of oral HPV, regardless of whether we were talking tobacco, marijuana, or the combined variable. In terms of the number of sex or kissing partners in the last year, the first bar shows the proportion the blue bars, the dark blue is traditional penile-vaginal sex. The middle column is oral sex, and the final bar is number of deep kissing partners had in the last year. And again, we also had data on lifetime, but this is just to sort of show you again what looks to be a dose-response relationship, especially with the number of oral sex partners. But we saw it with kissing as well, and we saw it with penile-vaginal as well. So again, you see the similar dose-response relationship across all three categories, and you think, well, maybe it's the same girls that have kissing and sex, smoking, and drinking. So we tried to stratify. I'm just going to show you one example of what we did. And here what we try to do is look at the alcohol graph, but stratify by the girls who reported 2 or fewer partners in the past year, compared to those who had 3 or more partners in the last year. And what you see is independent of how much sex they had, alcohol appeared to be a risk factor. And I can tell you when we did the same stratified analysis with smoking, independent of sex, the number of smoking frequency had a similar pattern. Only when we sort of looked at sex and frequency and we stratified by either smoking or alcohol, we didn't see quite as much of an impact in sex. And this is shown by this multivariable analysis where we actually did put all three of these variables in the model at the same time. That did require us to dichotomize the variables. And again, we didn't put anything else in the model because we only had 19 observations and wanted to keep it simple. But what you can see here for the sex partners is there, none of these, by the way, are statistically significant, but they sort of do show you trends. And if you look at the number of sex partners, you can see, again, it looks somewhat like a dose-response relationship. But with smoking frequency and alcohol frequency, again, it clearly looks like there's a dose response with the more smoking and the more drinking independently having a higher risk of acquiring oral HPV infections. And then we did create this index variable, and in the column that says number of risk factors, alcohol, smoking, or sex, we did actually just add them up to see what would happen if you had one, two, or three of these risk factors. And what you can see is that for the two-thirds of the women that did not have any of these, only 1.1% had an HPV infection. For those who had one, either one of the risk factors, 1.3% was positive. But if you had two or three, your risk really jumped up. So it does suggest either some type of synergistic effect. Again, it could be something about the women who do multiple risk behaviors, but it is interesting to suggest that it could be a combination and not just the independent thing. I got two slides to show you with results before the end, and this is just some interesting findings that we found. 5 minutes? Okay, no problem. So interestingly, if you had a tonsillectomy as 10% of the sample, none of the girls had oral HPV infections. And interestingly, those who reported any gastric reflux or heartburn, none of them reported had any observed HPV infections. And if you shared lipstick or toothpaste with someone else more than monthly, you actually had a 4 times increased risk of oral HPV infections. I'm curious to see if genital HPV correlated. This is self-reported. Have you ever had an abnormal pelvic exam or genital warts or genital HPV? And you can see that actually it was not at all associated with oral HPV. If anything, it's slightly fewer, but I don't think that we can make a claim there. The self-inoculation was interesting. We asked it a couple of different ways. There's really not a standard way to assess it in the literature, but any way that there was women reported having either their own hand or their partner's hand going from their genitals to their mouth, you can see that there was a big association with oral HPV infections. And then we were kind of interested in whether being on hormonal contraception might increase the risk. And those who were currently on hormonal contraception, again, it really wasn't that dramatic of a difference. So those are some things that either could be protective or could be risky. As far as follow-up, we tried to follow 30 women, just, again, sort of a not definitive sample, but just to see what might happen. We were able to follow 7 out of 10 subjects with at least one follow-up test, and 2 of those did have a HPV infection at any of the time points. However, that HPV infection was untyped. It means it was a different subtype than what they had at baseline. And of the 16 girls that we followed for up to a year in the control group, 2 of them had an HPV infection at one point during follow-up. So it's pretty high incidence if you think about it, but again, very low numbers. So it's just sort of suggesting what could be going on. So in terms of limitations, there are generalizability issues. We were on a single college campus in Florida. Some of the other recently published studies of oral HPV in this age group have also been at a single college campus. The NHANES did do a study that reported it. And then a thing that I'm interested in is whether our diagnostic test is really getting at it. Almost all the literature on oral HPV right now is using sort of this oral mouthwash and gargle test method. But you wonder whether it could be missing some type of latent HPV infections that are not shedding or that might be deep in the gums or somehow expressing on some days and not others. We did have a low number of outcome events. So again, all the data you see in some ways are somewhat exploratory. I don't think they prove causality. And then we only had follow-up in a small subset. So in terms of the incidence of oral HPV or the persistence of it, we still don't know a lot. And even again, in the literature, you're not going to see a whole lot of people followed for long periods of time. So inclusion oral HPV, and especially oral HPV 16, was not very common in college women. So screening and testing in this population seems unwarranted. That's an opinion, not fact, but it seems unwarranted. Alcohol, smoking, and sex appear to be independent risk factors, but also possibly synergistic. So in terms of why those women who engage in those activities were more likely to have oral HPV, is it sexually transmitted, or is it something about smoking and alcohol that might affect the oral immunology and thus leave people more susceptible or more likely to express HPV if they have it? The possible risks for self-inoculation are interesting. We did not do type-specific genital and oral at the same time, but that would be something interesting to look at. And the possible protection from a tonsillectomy or acid reflux or HPV vaccination, you know, is something that it would be interesting to see if that can be duplicated in further studies. None of the girls who had been vaccinated had HPV 16. So unanswered questions, when does the cancer-associated oral HPV 16 occur? Is it a stretch to think that a oral HPV infection acquired by an 18-year-old college woman or male will cause cancer at age 50? Right now, we don't really have, like in cervical cancer, we have these precancerous lesions. You can see the transition. You can measure intermediate steps to cancer. But right now, we don't have good markers of intermediate steps of oral cancer. Is oral HPV latent and shedding occasionally? That's going to involve us doing biopsies in the mouth or some type of different type of testing, or even daily serial testing. Are our current diagnostic tests adequate? You know, we're making a lot of conclusions about this, but maybe we are missing a lot. This really, the gold standard does seem to be the test we're using in the linear array assay, but it could be missing things. And it's still unclear whether screening in any population would prevent oral cancer, at least screening specifically for oral HPV. So I want to thanks to my outstanding Hopkins research team, thanks to the APHA for having me here today, and all of you for attending, to my lovely wife who's here in the audience, and some of my students, so thank you all very much for coming.